Clinched a berth to the Sweet 16 last night in Ames, Iowa.
Kentucky senior guard Kayla Snowden grew up in Lexington. She hit the go-ahead basket to give the second-seeded Wildcats a 65-62 win over Green Bay.
I'll just look back and really admire it. I mean, I put in a lot of work in the gym, getting shots up, and I mean, just having that shot get us into the Sweet 16, I mean, it means the world to me.
The Wildcat women, now 27-6, move on to the Kingston, Rhode Island Regional. The Kentucky men, the overall number one seed in the tournament, will play at the South Regional in Atlanta. For NPR News, I'm Greg Eklund in Ames, Iowa.
And I'm Paul Brown. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Principal Financial Group, managing investments and working to help build dreams for more than 130 years. The Principal at dreamagain.com.
Tuesday night, WILL is your source for the latest primary election results and analysis. The Illinois Public Media News team will keep you apprised of results in the presidential primary, national and state legislative and judicial races, plus Champaign County offices and referenda. I'm Craig Cohen. Join me Tuesday night starting at 7 Central Time for live results and analysis on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Good morning. Glad to have you with us. This morning, both hours of the program come from the Focus Archives. They are shows that we first broadcast in late January. So that means as you listen this morning, for both hours, we'll not be taking calls. Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. It's possible to go through life carrying out a range of complex tasks without consciously paying attention to what we are doing, doing things in the same way, following the same set of internal rules, and living by the same set of assumptions. And while it is possible to live that way, you do end up missing a lot. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Harvard professor Ellen Langer. She is a scholar who has been called the mother of the psychological concept of mindfulness. It is a very simple but powerful idea that by paying attention, and that is attention defined in a particular way that we'll discuss, by paying attention to what we're doing, we will better understand the world, ourselves, other people, and in the process, we will live a more full and more healthy life. Our guest has authored a number of books, a couple of 100 research articles on a number of subjects, including the illusion of control, successful aging, decision making, and in all of those cases, really, it is her theory of mindfulness that helps frame all of those issues. Our best-selling books include Mindfulness, The Power of Mindful Learning, On Becoming an Artist, and her most recent, which is titled Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility. She is joining us this morning by phone, and we're very happy to be able to talk with her. And Professor Langer, hello.
Hi. Thank you for that lovely introduction, David.
Well, thanks for being with us. I really have the really enjoy the opportunity here to talk with you. This was an idea of my producers. Maybe she thought I could use a little dose of mindfulness, and that would be a good thing for me to do. You know, and as a way of introducing people to the idea of mindfulness as you think about it and what you mean when you use that word, because different people do use it differently. I actually thought it might be interesting to ask as a beginning question before talking about mindfulness, to talk about mindlessness. And for you, if you use a word like that, what does that mean?
When people are mindless, they're trapped in a rigid perspective. The interesting thing about it is that we're oblivious to being mindless. You know, so you have lots of folk psychology saying, be in the moment. And it's really an empty instruction, because when you're not in the moment, you're not there to know you're not there. And the research that we've done now for over 35 years suggests that mindlessness is pervasive. Virtually all of us, most of the time, are not there. Mm. So it's a big problem, to say the least. You're in this being trapped in a single perspective. Another way of understanding it is people have an illusion of stability. We keep trying to hold things still, when in fact everything is changing and looks different from different perspectives. So all of our certainties lead us to be mindless. Once you think you know, there's no reason to pay attention. And that's the mistake, because what we know is true in one context, but not necessarily in another.
You know, one very useful metaphor, I think, as a way of helping people understand, and I know that this is one that you have employed a lot, which comes out of work that you have done with teachers. When you say to teachers, you know, you say to your students, I want you to pay attention. And then you ask the teacher, now, when you say to them, I want you to pay attention, what exactly do you mean by that? And they give you, it seems fairly consistently, they and then the students also repeat the same metaphor.
Right, that what they think paying attention means is to hold the image still as if you're looking through a camera. And when you do that, it turns out if everybody just looked at their finger while they're listening to the radio show, unless you're driving and look at something else, and hold the image absolutely still, it's very difficult. The image keeps moving around and it's boring. But if instead you mindfully pay attention, and what that means is so simple it almost defies belief, that all you need to do is actively notice new things. So even if you were looking at your finger, so I'm looking at my finger now and I notice there's a red spot there and it's chubby little finger and so on, that in noticing new things, it becomes very easy to pay attention. So in an early study, we had people who had an attention deficit problem, the elderly who are accused often of not being able to pay attention, and Harvard students who are supposed to be so good they don't need any instruction, all focus on stimuli that we presented in the way that people typically do, holding the image still, or we had them mindfully attend. And across the board with each of these, even the Harvard students, everybody improved by simply noticing new things. You know, the data are sort of remarkable, and we've accumulated so much over all these years that almost whatever measure we put in, when we teach people to be more mindful, we get improvements. We get people being more competent, being happier, being healthier, being more creative, charismatic. There are fewer accidents. It just goes on and on. And the thing that's most interesting to me is that not only is it so easy to do, but it is energy begetting. It's exciting. It's the way you feel when you're at your best, when you're most engaged. So you want to be engaged in something, you simply notice new things, and that leads to that engagement. So there's no reason not to do it, in other words.
So it's really the thing here is on the one hand it's very easy to do, but on the other hand you have to make a deliberate effort to do it.
Well, no, not really.
No.
You just have to be aware of, in some sense, all the costs that you're incurring by this mindlessness. And so, you know, people spend parts of the day being mindful. When you're laughing, enjoying something, the only way it's enjoyable is if it's done mindfully, noticing new things. When you travel, people pay a lot of money to have a mindset that says, look for new things, right? You're going to some foreign place, you're open to noticing novelty. And in doing so, you have a wonderful time. So that it really doesn't require any effort. Just the instruction, hey, look, you've been absent from your life, sealed in an unlived life for too long.
Just also as a way of filling this out, there are, as I said, different people may use the term mindfulness in different ways, and maybe people have some association between Buddhism and meditation practice and the word mindfulness. And while perhaps that and this is, they're not unconnected, when Buddhists talk about mindfulness, they're talking about something a little bit different.
Yes, that for all of these programs that are not related to mind directly, that people meditate. So you take 20 minutes twice a day out of your day, and that meditation leads to post-meditative mindfulness. What I'm talking about is a more direct way of getting to essentially the same place. So they're not at odds at all, and one can do both rather easily. But this is, you know, I found myself that for lots of the people I know, and I may know strange people, it's hard for them to sit still for 5 minutes once a day. So to meditate for twice a day wasn't going to happen. And this is a very healthy alternative. But as you mentioned, they're not at odds with each other, just different ways of getting to the same place.
Have you, as you have explained, this is something that you have been studying and thinking about for several decades. How did you get into this line of research?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question. I think that when I moved from New York, where I had a sense of people being very street smart, to Cambridge to teach at Harvard, where you know you had a sense that there were all these high IQ people all over the place. And I noticed things that seemed odd to me that I thought would never happen in New York. For instance, you go into a bank and one line has 10 people on it, another line has 2 people on it. You know, in New York, the people who are in positions 5, 6, 7, and it would quickly move over to the other line. This was many years ago, and at that time the bank was closed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So that meant there was parking available at no cost, and yet nobody parked there. So I sort of had free rein when I moved up here. So there were lots of things like that, and then it became very clear that mindlessness is not stupidity. Then these are very smart people who are just not there because of this illusion of certainty and oblivious, again, to the fact that they're not there. So that was part. The other had to do with my grandmother at the time was in a nursing home and I believed was misdiagnosed with I think she was said to have dementia or senility, as it was called then, because she spoke of a snake in her head. And she, you know, this was just her colorful way of speaking. What she was saying was that my head hurts. But because that was different from the language of the people who were caring for her, she was misdiagnosed, and the brain tumor she had was not noticed until it was too late. And so that also led me to search for alternative ways of understanding people's behavior. What we typically do is you see somebody doing something, and if there's any motivation, you find a reason for it, and then you think you know, when there are many different reasons, and those different reasons might lead you to respond to the person very differently. So, for example, if you thought I was impulsive, you might want to avoid me. If instead you thought I was spontaneous, you might want to approach. If you thought that I was grim, you'd want to stay away. If instead you thought that I was a serious kind of person, you know, you'd respond differently. And so on for every characterization we have about people. So if you think somebody is rigid, that's bad. When you realize that that rigidity is what makes the person stable, someone you can count on, then again, you respond differently. And so by watching people and by seeing all of the costs that they were bearing by these single-minded views, the theory started to unfold.
Hmm. And that's also something I think that's been important to you, or thought it was an important idea. If you look at this in a developmental sense, something about the way in which our attitudes, the way we look at the world or the way we look at other people, those are things that can be set very early, and we
yes.
carry them throughout the whole rest of our lives.
Right, exactly. No, that's the biggest problem, that we learn at a time when it doesn't matter a whole lot to us, and we freeze that understanding. And then later, when it would be to our advantage to open up that idea, it doesn't occur to us to do so. So a simple example, although this is just mindlessness affecting us indirectly. Let's say you're 20 years old and your wrist hurts. Well, we all have the idea that your wrist isn't supposed to hurt at 20. So what you do is you do things to make your wrist better. If your wrist hurts and you're 70 years old, and you, when you were younger, bought into the mindset that as you get older, you start to fall apart. Then you might say to yourself, well, what do you expect? I'm 70 years old. So then you don't do anything. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Our guest knows I thought you were
I was just going to say, we tend to live out these mindsets without an awareness that we had choices, that things could have been different.
Yeah. Well, our guest in this hour, I'd just like to introduce, for the benefit of anybody who might have just tuned in, we are talking with Ellen Langer. She is a professor of psychology at Harvard University and is particularly associated with her work in the psychological concept of mindfulness. And she's written a number of books about this. And you might, if you're interested, you might want to take a look at her book, Mindfulness, which has been out now for a while. Some others include The Power of Mindful Learning, and her most recent is Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility, which really takes a look at very interesting connections between mindfulness and aging and how we think about aging and literally how the associations between mindfulness or mindlessness and how we feel. It's something that she argues can actually affect people's longevity, all of these really interesting ideas. And so questions, comments are welcome. I have someone here ready to go on the phone. Others should feel welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Also, there's an email, which is will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here in Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll-free line. We'll go there, line four. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
I've got a question regarding how you think technology fits into the mindless idea, and the fact that, say, when you're driving and you see somebody texting, they're obviously mindless, and of course you can use this metaphor for all kinds of technology things that would, in my opinion, cause mindlessness. You might think the technology is the other way, but I'm interested to hear what you have to say about that, so I'm going to listen.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting, you know, that no matter what we're doing, we can do it mindfully or mindlessly, whether it has to do with technology, reading, eating a sandwich, playing golf, no matter what, it can be done one of two ways with very different repercussions following the particular way. So for technology, something occurred to me the other day that may be interesting, surprising, that you have all of this potential misinformation on the Internet. Now, one might think that that's bad. The misinformation and abundance of information about health, I think, is actually a very good thing, because what happens is when you get conflicting reports, then you have to sit back and think about the situation and take in new data. So with respect to health, you'd attend to your own body in a slightly different way that I think would have very positive consequences. Technology for many people who just, sort of following, it's like following a recipe where you step out of the equation and it says add two teaspoons of this and one tablespoon of that, and you mindlessly do it. Yes, to the extent that technology leads us step by step, it's going to promote mindlessness. So with the recipe, for example, you might say to yourself, gee, I like things sweeter, and even though it's asking for one tablespoon of sugar, perhaps you should put in two. So you make it your own. But I don't think that there's anything about technology per se. You know, the people who are texting while they're driving might have been doing something that was also problematic before cell phones came around. They're not likely to be our best drivers. It's also interesting that if one is texting or desires to text, and I know this is an unpopular view, I hesitate to say because I'm not sure I even believe it, but that when you believe that what you're doing is taking attention away from an activity, that may lead you to pay more attention to what you're doing. I spent some time in Mexico, and there's this very busy street, several of them, where there are no traffic signs. There are no stoplights, no stop signs. There is nothing but a lot of traffic. And because everybody knows that accidents could occur, and there's nobody telling them what to do, everybody pays attention. And there are no accidents, as it turns out, on those streets. You know, so if one is mindlessly texting, oblivious to the potential consequences, yes, I agree with you that this is clearly not going to be good. But I don't think technology itself promotes that.
Here's someone who writes in as an email, says, I know after a long day of work, being able to turn my mind off when I go home is a blessing. She writes, I understand the value of mindfulness, but I also understand the value of mindlessness.
Yeah,
the question is that, you know, is that not sometimes mindlessness is okay?
Yeah, no, I'm faced with that frequently. I believe that mindlessness is virtually always a problem, and that what people want to turn off is not their mindfulness. They want to turn off their mindless stress, their mindless worries about doing this or that thing correctly and so on. It's not the thought itself. It's the evaluation that leads us to want to run away from it.
All right. Let's talk with another caller in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I'm glad to hear this information being laid out in the pattern that's being laid out. In the past month, I've developed a theory based on comic books, the same principle, I think. And if not, I most certainly can be corrected. The author of comic books develops the characters through, of course, thinking in his own head regarding what he wants the characters to be. But you could say that that is working with reality, creating fantasy. But once he enters the bubble, that is, each square of the comic book has those bubbles overhead, and entered into those bubbles is another mind. Once that person enters into that mind, which could be considered most certainly the author's explanation of the fantasy of the person who is doing the acting or doing the thinking, then I think there is something lost there if the author, in his application, participates more in the fantasy than they do in the reality of creating the characters themselves. Now, the reason I'm saying this is because there are many of us who know what the truth is, but can't face that truth, so we create our own fantasy continually and participate in that to avoid being discovered that we do not know something.
And that's interesting. I wasn't sure where you were going with this.
Yeah, so I'm
and
sorry.
I can't relate. You know, the last time I read a comic was too long ago. At first, I thought you were going to say that with these other bubbles in the comic strip that you're getting alternative viewpoints, in which case it's clearly leading us to be more mindful. With respect to the fantasy and running away from fantasy, when you say that there are some of us who know, that's what I take issue with, because essentially all is unknowable. You know, that what happens, because things are constantly changing and, again, look different from different perspectives, once we think we know it, it's already something that's different. And that when people run away from things, in fact, they would be better off thinking about those very things differently. So, for example, if somebody is stressed that something is going to happen, if they simply said to themselves, what are 5, 3, 6, it doesn't matter, reasons that it might not happen, And you start opening it up, so first you're sure it's going to happen. Now you start to see, well, yeah, maybe it won't happen. And if you also say, what are some of the possible advantages of it happening? And the more of this you do, the more you see, you don't know if it's going to happen or not, but if it happens, you don't have to be afraid of it. And so it's the certainty that something bad is going to happen that you can't face. So by looking at it, what you come to see is the uncertainty. And it's a positive uncertainty. Instead of certainty, it's going to be bad. You know, if it's fine, if it happens, it's fine. If it doesn't happen, then one doesn't have to think about it one way or the other.
Yes. Now, that most certainly I agree with. But the thing I'm trying to work with is the self to evaluate that. In other words, if one spends more time in the fantasy, there is no self-assurance to evaluate those principles. So I call that developing a self. If he has no self, and the mind is a tool to develop that self, but there must be the evaluation process for some level of stability on which to launch those possibilities you just mentioned.
I'm not sure what to say about that. I think that all of the things we engage in, whether somebody's calling it a fantasy or somebody else calls it a reality, give us information that's potentially useful for us. The problem, or a problem, tends to be that when we're doing something in one context, if we have firm boundaries around it, it doesn't occur to us that that information is also relevant in another context. So you can be doing something that's fantasy, but if you have a sense that, and all fantasy is grounded in some ways in reality, that it's a two-way street, then that time imagining these unusual things, these wonderful things, might lead to discoveries or inventions that otherwise wouldn't happen.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I got some other people I want to get to. The thing that just made me think about was just the general and not terribly exciting observation that one of the reasons that we read fiction is that it's an opportunity to try on somebody else's worldview. That is to get a sense of how the world looks to someone different. And then I started thinking, well, really isn't that what artists, and you're an artist, isn't that really what artists are trying to get us to do? And that is to see the world in a different way.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and a slightly different take on this, that there are people who, when they put on the mindset of somebody else, are able to do things that as themselves they can't do. And if one becomes aware of this, so for example, we did a study on vision where we had young men play the parts of Air Force pilots who they believed had superior vision, and that they then flew a flight simulator as if they were Air Force pilots and looked out over the outside the window at the wing of an oncoming plane and were able to read letters from an eye chart that were smaller than they were able to read when they were just themselves. Mm. So, and if I'm in the shower thinking I'm Maria Callas or Barbara Streisand, I sing on tune. When I'm just singing, I'm not singing on tune. Well, there's something strange about that. All I have to do is make the connection that this fantasy is a potential reality.
Yeah. Well, that also makes me think of this now, a pretty famous study that you did where you had two groups of older men, and this is greatly oversimplifying it, but you set up a situation where you had one group and essentially you encouraged them to think about, to reminisce about their experiences when they were young, just to kind of think about that. And then, but you had another group, what you were trying to get them to do was not just to think about it, not just to remember it, how it felt, but to feel how it felt, to put yourself back there in a way. And the difference was, is that by, you can actually change the way that you feel by telling yourself you are a different person. So maybe
by removing the mindless impediments, all of those things we've learned that say we can't. So we had these old men live in this retreat that was retrofitted to 20 years earlier to live as if it was the past. That means they spoke about past events in the present tense. With the reminiscing group, for them, it was always the past, although they talked about the same things. And the improvements were extraordinary. At the end of this, they looked younger, their vision improved, their hearing improved, their mental facilities improved, and so on. One of the things about that study that was so interesting to me was that the comparison group, while they didn't improve as much as the experimental group, they also improved, because here were old men. They were 80-ish, in their 80s, and that was when 80 was 80, not the new 60. A time when they were overhelped, overcared for, most responsibility was taken from them in a loving way. Now all of a sudden they were thrown into an environment where they were in charge. They had to look after themselves and so on. And it signaled such a different way of a different set of expectations for themselves that they too showed a great deal of improvement. And I just did a series for the BBC the summer before last that replicated that study with British celebrities. And I feel even more strongly about these results. And they're based on a very simple, again, idea that the, this may be too complicated for now, but let me give it a shot. Feel free to stop me. That we have what's typically called the mind-body problem, mm-hmm. which is how do you get from this fuzzy thing called a thought to the material body? And to me, mind, body, these are just words. They're concepts that I think that we use relatively mindlessly. So I said, let's put the mind and body back together. And if we do that, then we're necessarily putting the mind, or vice versa. And so then I did a series of studies. This counterclockwise study that you just described was the first of them, where we put the mind in healthier places and then took our measurements and in each case find improvement. Let me tell you about one of these that's kind of fun. In one case, we have people looking at an eye chart. Now, all of us have been in doctor's offices, and we see this eye chart where the letters get progressively smaller. Well, implicitly, that tells us that soon we're not going to be able to see. So we did a very simple thing. We reversed the eye chart. So now the letters get progressively larger, thereby telling us soon we will be able to see. And what happens is people can see what they couldn't see before. Most of us have the view that, around two-thirds of the way down the eye chart, I'm not going to be able to see. So what we did was start, for another group, the eye chart down a third of the way. So when you get two-thirds of the way down, the letters are much, much smaller. And again, people were able to see what they couldn't see before. And all of these studies lead me to believe that we have far, far more control over our health, our well-being, than most people imagine.
In this hour, the guest is Ellen Langer. She's a professor of psychology at Harvard University. She has authored many books and research papers on subjects including the illusion of control, successful aging, decision-making, and all of those really considered in the frame of her theory of mindfulness, which we have been talking about. And again, if you'd like to read some more of her work, you can look for the book Mindfulness. That's a good introduction to the subject. Or her most recent that takes a look at some of the things we were just talking about here in this last part of the conversation. You might want to look at that book, which is Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility. We have
David,
several calls. Oh, yes, yes.
Your listeners might want to know that the first chapter of Counterclockwise is on my website, which is cleverly called ellenlanger.com.
Ah, so they can, for free, they can read the first chapter. Excellent. Go to ellenlanger.com. Very good. We have several callers here, and people have been waiting patiently, so I will go on and talk. We'll talk with some more folks. Next, our caller is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Langer.
Hi.
Well, I live in Urbana, and this is an academic community, as you're speaking of with Harvard, and I am not an academic. But I have noticed, I believe, some things about the community, which I'm curious what you think about. One is, in the academia community, people speak with authority, and I think that sometimes they forget dialogue.
Uh-huh.
And lecture becomes the mode versus conversation, as you were talking about earlier, about being open-minded, which sometimes, to my opinion, leads to complacency. And I was wondering if all of this is related to a competitiveness. What do you think about competition and being open-minded?
Oh, well, I think that academics speak with authority for many reasons. I don't... competitiveness might be in there somewhere. But I think that what happens is you have your A students become academics, and to be an A student in our culture, you have to memorize a lot. And so then you end up with a lot of certainty. And if you know something for sure, why not say it and say it with authority? And the problem is that all of these facts are context-bound, and people are oblivious to that. You know, I was at this horse event, and this person asked me if I'd watch his horse because he was going to go get his horse a hot dog. Well, I'm one of those A students, Harvard, Yale, all the way through. And so I'm laughing to myself, but was polite, on saying, what are you kidding? To myself, horses are herbivorous. They don't eat meat. He went and he got the hot dog, and the horse ate it, which I love. I'm one of the few people, I think, who likes being wrong, because then you learn something. And then I thought, what does it mean, horses don't eat meat? How many horses were tested? How hungry were the horses? How much meat was mixed with how much grain, and so on? And these are the hidden questions that researchers use, but readers and even the researchers themselves become oblivious to. If you change any of those parameters, you may get different answers. And what happens is that for the research on which all the certainty is based, research only gives us probabilities. So most horses, under most circumstances, might not eat meat is a very different statement from all horses don't eat meat.
Mm-hmm.
When you think you know, you speak with authority, cut off dialogue often, as you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that the certainty keeps you from questioning the information at a time when now, being older, wiser, as these faculty people are, they might come up with very different conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Do you think
I didn't speak to competition per se, but you can see where competition plays in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're younger, you're competing for the grades, then you're competing for the job, and you get lots of feedback saying, yes, you're the person who knows.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think we need to do is pay more attention to alternative views. And I'm not as big on grades and grading as many academics, of course. And I wrote that in The Power of Mindful Learning. And then at some point, somebody points it out in a large class. And, you know, I throw my hands up and say, you know, I have other battles to fight. So, yes, I will grade them.
Well, thank you for the comment. I hope that it'd be okay if I go on here and go to the next person in line who also happens to be in Urbana, and this would be line number 3. Hello.
Interesting comments the previous caller made, but I want to get in my points. There were 3 books, 2 of which I've read, 1 of which my husband is reading, although it's his gift to me for Christmas, but he's reading it. The first was Delusions of Gender, How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference. It's a book we've read in our book group a few months ago. One of the things, she's got lots of research in that, which is very interesting, which some of which fits in with what you're talking about. But one thing stands out in my mind, and she's quoting a transgendered person who's gone from male to female, and he's saying it was interesting how the things he used to be able to confidently do as a man, when he became a woman, and men assumed that he could not do them, he suddenly became, felt as though he was less capable of doing them.
Yeah.
Things got heavier or et cetera, which I thought was an interesting view. Then another one, I just finished reading Free Range Knitter, The Yarn Harlot Writes Again. There's short essays on life by somebody who knits continually. And at one point she's talking about having multiple projects going on, and she knits them at different times depending on what else she is doing.
Mm-hmm.
When she's going to be doing something else that requires a lot of concentration, she'll choose knitting that does not require a lot of concentration, that she can do almost automatically. If she's going to be in a waiting room waiting for a doctor, she takes something that's more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that speaks to what else we can do in terms of multitasking. I would not cross a busy intersection in Kathmandu talking on a cell phone.
And I wasn't suggesting that in Mexico people are on their cell phones. You know, on the contrary, that because they know that they have to pay attention, that cell phones, cups of coffee, anything that might be distracting, are put aside.
Yeah. Then my husband and I were walking to a basketball game, and we were walking along St. Mary's Road, which doesn't have sidewalks and is very uneven on the grassy side. So, and it was winter, the wind was blowing, and so I was paying attention to my footing, and we were late, so my husband wanted to walk faster, and he was complaining that I was walking too slowly. And particularly started complaining about this just after he'd asked me a genealogical question about how some relative of his was related to another relative. And I slowed down, thinking about how do I explain this again to him so that it will relate to what he knows and what he will understand. And when I said to him, you know, that's not fair. I'm focusing on this other thing, and I can't focus on where my feet go and that and walk at a fast pace. And he said, oh, that's really interesting, because he was reading Kahneman's Thinking, Fast and Slow, and he said that, I'm paraphrasing here, that mathematicians or some other kind of research person, they'll often discuss things together out when they're out for a walk, but if they're asked to actually do a computation, such as multiplying two-digit numbers together, they will stop,
mm-hmm.
because they can't do the computation and walk at the same time. I thought that was really interesting. Anyway, fits into what you're saying. I'm going to get with your books. It sounds very useful.
Well, it sounds like you have a wonderful relationship, let me say that. And, you know, the book about Jen, I haven't read, didn't read that, or the knitting book, that with respect to gender, there are so many cues in the environment and things that we're specifically taught that tell us we can't. And I spend some time in the counterclockwise book debunking the idea of uncontrollability. We can never prove that we can't. All we can show is that so far we haven't been able to. But once you believe you can't, then you don't pay any attention, you don't try. And then, of course, you're not going to accomplish whatever it is. And the trying is itself fun. It's a shame that when people are called male or female, that they're not able to do one activity or the other. There is some old research where when people, Asian women, are taking math tests, and if we prime, so this is putting them in their Asian bodies in some sense, calling to mind their Asian identities, they're able to do all the math brilliantly. When their femininity, their femaleness, their gender is primed, since women are not supposed to be able to do well at math, then they do poorly. What I think is important is for us to recognize that we can prime for ourselves whatever identity, even if it's our own or somebody else's, that will allow us to do things that we were hesitant to do. You know, so if you're afraid to do something, ask somebody something, and your husband, for example, is more assertive or vice versa in this regard, then you just, you know, approach the issue as if you're your husband. And what would he do, and how would he say it? And then the piece that people often forget is that they were the ones that actually accomplished the task. So then, next time around, you don't have to be that other person. Anyway, so again, we prevent ourselves from accomplishing and being many of the things that we would like to be by these mindsets that keep us in place.
We have about 5 or 6 minutes in this part of Focus. Ellen Langer is our guest. She's a professor of psychology at Harvard University. We have one more caller here, Belgium nearby, the town nearby, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to maybe put something in on the table that you might, you know, I don't think you've discussed it yet. Last September, I took a ride down the California coast, area called Big Sur. And as I'm riding along, I come across a restaurant that is just nice. So my wife and I go out and go into the restaurant, have a fabulous meal, and it's beautiful view, and it's just so relaxing and so nice. And I don't think I've been any place more beautiful in my whole life. And on the way out, I asked, I assume the proprietor, what's the name of this place? And he said, Nepenthe. I said, Nepenthe? What is Nepenthe? He says, Nepenthe is an elixir of forgetfulness. It's mentioned by Homer in the Iliad to keep Odysseus from wanting to go home and leave the island of one of the monsters. And for months now, I've been thinking about Nepenthe. Nepenthe is very important. An ability to forget things that are bad, things that might hurt you, insults, ways to put yourself in a nice mind frame that really helps you move along in life. And you've never mentioned the ability to forget. Now, some people forget with drugs. Some people forget with alcohol. Some people forget with a beautiful view.
Well, I think that my own view is very different. I think that, of course, we're going to forget certain things. And if you're in the present, you're not going to be attending to things that happened before or worrying about things in the future. But for those negative events, what I suggest is that we realize that evaluation is in our heads. It's not in the things we're evaluating. Events are neither good nor bad. These are views we impose on the events. So that an alternative that many people, you know, so you have, let's say, three alternatives. One is you think about this negative thing and you get yourself crazy. Two, which is probably better than one, is that you run away from it, you go and you have a nice meal and you try not to think about that negative thing. Now, there's evidence that trying not to think about something will actually lead you to think about it more. But then there's the third alternative, which is the one that I think is most effective, which is to think about that event, but to think about it differently, to open it up and to recognize this thing that's so scary may not happen again. If it happens, it in fact comes with a potential for a whole different view, so that it may actually be a good thing rather than a bad thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're coming down to, we have a couple of minutes. Scientists are always, or maybe you should be, always questioning what it is they think they know. The idea is that they have a particular view of the way the world works, and maybe they have some data to support that. But at the same time, they always should be saying, but is this right? Is this really the way that it is? At the same time, I think if one has been doing something for a long time, maybe you're invested in a particular set of theories,
right,
or way of looking at the world. So for you personally, as a researcher, how do you avoid being mindless as a researcher and continuing to say to yourself, I think this is the way it is, but is that the way it is?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I probably fall into the trap as often as anybody else with respect to these theories. I think that what I do is ask myself explicitly, and I think many researchers actually have to do this, because in order to create the proper experiment, you need control groups that you derive by saying, how might this be explained in other ways? How might I be wrong? I keep being amazed at how many things fall into this theory, and that, you know, for me right now, I honestly believe that no matter what you're doing it either mindlessly or mindfully, and there are strong advantages of doing it mindfully. And the statement that's probably most extreme is that virtually all of the ills we experience as individuals, as partners in a relationship, as members of a community, as citizens of a country, that all of the ills derive one way or the other from mindlessness, either directly or indirectly. And so, you know, when I talk about this, I sort of put it out there for someone to challenge me and say, well, what about? And if I can come up with a way that it speaks to it, you know, then I can continue making that statement. I haven't been challenged yet to think otherwise, but, you know, I'm open to it. I have so much data that it would be interesting for me to take the piece, any new piece, that doesn't quite fit and figure out how the theory needs to be changed. It's hard for me to imagine that it would be anything that would lead to the unraveling of all of it. But, you know, who knows?
Well, I could see it seems certainly to me to make sense in interpersonal relations, and that can be a source of a problem if for example, if there's a person and you think, oh, I know everything there is to know about this person, and I couldn't possibly learn anything new about them. Well,
yeah.
You know, that gets to the point where then that person, you know, and if this is a significant person in your life, that person starts to be a little fuzzy and start to vanish. And I could also see the argument that says, you know, that we hold ourselves back from achieving things and doing things and learning things simply because we say to ourselves, we can't.
Right.
And certainly I think that probably people get into a lot of problems in their lives simply because they're bored. And I think that probably a big symptom of mindlessness is boredom. So if you're constantly seeking something new simply because the world is so uninteresting, that can also be a problem too.
Wait, you lost me then.
Maybe I went too far.
Because if it is the case that you're bored, and so a remedy to your boredom is to seek out engagement by noticing novelty and new things, then you're not going.
Oh, that's okay. But I guess I'm thinking of simple thrill seeking. Maybe is a problem. Well, for people, we'll have to, at any rate, with that clumsy observation on my part, we'll have to stop. Our guest Ellen Langer is professor of psychology at Harvard University. You can look for her books, including Mindfulness, if you want to read about that, or if you'd like to read the first chapter of her recent book, Counterclockwise. That's available on her website, which is ellenlanger.com. And Professor Langer, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives, a show we first broadcast on January 27th. You can listen to past programs, check the schedule by going to the website. That's will.illinois.edu.
This fall, visit England and Wales, locations made famous in Last of the Summer Wine, Downton Abbey, and more, including Agatha Christie's home on the coast of South Devon. Does American history suit you? Well, travel in private vintage train cars on our Civil War train. This September's itinerary includes important southern battlefields and discussions with historian Anthony Pitch. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300.
Just a quick reminder that tonight here on WILO, we'll have coverage of today's Illinois primary starting at 7 o'clock. And then tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour of this show, we'll be talking about the primary and about national and Illinois politics with two guests, Jamie Dunn from Illinois Issues Magazine and also Professor John Jackson from the Paul Simon Institute at Southern Illinois University. That's on Focus tomorrow. We'll take a break as we usually do here. We'll bring you an update on the market. Stay tuned.
WILL agricultural programs and services are made possible by the Friends of WILL and by Strategic Farm Marketing, Boulder Design, Stuart Peterson, and Pioneer Seeds. Thank you for your continued support.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets at mid-session, where U.S. grain and soybean futures are lower across the board, stumbling on broader-based selling across most asset classes today. Investors today reducing risk across the board a feature encouraging traders to take profits after we've seen gains in corn and soybeans in prior weeks. Favorable weather, improving crop conditions for developing winter wheat crops, and increasing odds of increased U.S. corn plantings are putting pressure on the marketplace as well. Let's look at the particulars in Kansas City. May wheat